Okay, good morning. It is so good to see everybody. Let us carry on learning. We are now addressing a very unusual and very special mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. Just quickly, by a show of hands, who here has had the opportunity of doing Pidyon HaBen? Okay, so we have a few. I myself am my first son as well, so I don't remember it very clearly myself, but nonetheless, it was twice at least in my side, in direct experience. And this is a very special mitzvah, a very special mitzvah. And most people don't know so much about it, and there are lots of very fascinating questions and permutations. And because you only usually get to have this maybe once in a lifetime, then it happens to be that a lot of times we don't get a chance to study it, appreciate it, and understand some of the complicated permutations that relate to this as well. Let's deal with some of the nuts and bolts, and then some of the ideas behind it as well. So, who needs to do the Pidyon HaBen? Who is responsible? The Torah tells us the Shulchan Aruch says that it is a mitzvah for the father to redeem his son. So a father as a child has the responsibility of redeeming that child from the age of a month old as well. It is unusual in the sense that unlike the Bris Milah, that when a father fails to do so, it falls upon the community. When it comes to Pidyon HaBen, that is not the case. It falls upon the person themselves, but not until the stage that they're able to do so. So that means to say that, let's say you have a situation where a father doesn't know, doesn't want, doesn't have money, whatever it is, and doesn't do the Pidyon HaBen, then there is a void. That child will have a responsibility until the age of 13, will not be able to carry that out. At the age of 13, that child will need to facilitate doing a Pidyon HaBen. It's not the most difficult procedure in the world. It's not talking out of Bris Milah. So it is possible to be done at such a stage. It falls incumbent upon a person. So who cannot do a Pidyon HaBen is the more important question. And so there's a lot of people who are precluded from this, which is why it is less of a common mitzvah. So first is a girl, right? So meaning to say, so we cut out 50% of the population right there, because if the firstborn is a girl, there's no Pidyon HaBen. It's only if there's a ben first as well. So we're really up 50% of firstborns. Next a child who is born to a Kohen or a Levi, but not just a Kohen or a Levi, even a Bas Kohen or a Bas Levi as well. Now again, it's hard to know what the percentages are. One of the sense I said that priests, the Kohen and Leviim, account for 4% of the population. So again, if we knock it down again and exclude them, but it's not clear if that's referring to only the men in the Kohanim or the Leviim, but their children as all will be precluded as well from Pidyon HaBen. More complicated situations are where let's say we're dealing with a child who is born after a miscarriage. So let's say there is a miscarriage which happens, and then there's a child, then there's a boy which is born. That is not considered a petras rechem, the beginning or the responsibility of a Pidyon HaBen. The responsibility does not kick in. How far along would that have to be? The way the Shulchan Aruch paskens, and what is certainly Rav Shechta accepts as mainstream halacha, even though there are different approaches, is 40 days. So if which is generally the moment beyond which it's moving from what the Gemara calls a stage of Maya Ba'alma, which is an expansion, expanding biological mass of cells, turning into the development of a child. It's pretty amazing, by the way, in the biology. I was just reading about this, and I when I was in high school, you had to make choices between subjects. So it was history or biology, and physics, and it was physics. I don't remember what the alternative was, but I took the history track for some reason, so I missed biology. So I had to re-educate myself afterwards, and so it was like just amazing to study all these things and how a cell, which is identical to another cell, suddenly understands, is activated in such a way that some of the coding is activated, that this will now become a cell of an organ versus the cell of a skin or muscle, or how this will be the top or the bottom of the fetus. And there's this process is happening all the time as cells are being activated and now turned into specific different types of cells, even though they all started off the same. It's a remarkable process. So at which point in the process, when is that what's called the Ramah calls merukam, where there's, so to speak, form? So the Shulchan Aruch takes it that that's 40 days. So if it's an early term miscarriage, that doesn't hit the radar. But if it's after then a child born after that would not be considered a peter rechem, a son born after that as well. Another, which just will take a lot of people off the grid, is cesarean sections, so C-sections. If a child is born not naturally, so not through the vaginal canal, but it has to be taken out, that child will not have a pigeon aben, and that's very common. That's very common. It'll just, depending on the needs, the high-risk pregnancy, what's happening with the baby during labor. So there's a lot of reasons why a child may not have a pigeon aben. Some put it, I've heard colloquially, at 7% of children would so to speak, hit the requirement of a pigeon aben, such a very low percentage in terms of the amount of children who might be involved in this. So being as that's the case, that's why it is that if you look around an average room, it's only a few hands that go up when it comes to a pigeon aben, and it might just be one of the children, because remember, it's not just one person. Meaning, if you ask every person how many people actually did a pigeon aben, it's even lower than the people who have it in their family, right? Just because of the nature of this as well.
We went a century
without a pigeon aben. There you go. Right. I know some Kohanim have waited a few centuries, and just now, you know, it's been years. Dr. Honeyman.
Corollary that, how was the pigeon to fast Erev Pesach? Is the same thing would go on these people that like the fasting Erev Pesach for Bechor, the same thing if they were born after a miscarriage?
That's a really good question. I don't know if the Tanis Bechorim follows the same rules as the Pidgin Aben as well. I'm not sure as well. That's a very, very good question. I don't believe so. I know that a lot of parents are fast or go to CMM on Erev Pesach. I'm not sure if that's the same, because there are different rules for Pidgin. There's different rules for a Bechor. There's different what called areas in Halacha. There's also Bechor LaNachla, which does not follow the same rules as Pidgin Haben. Lockers as well. So just to understand that these operates independently. I'm not sure the parallel to that as well. There might be a good reason too, and we'll get there in a second. Yes.
So if there's something about the 40 days, do you do it or you don't do it?
That's a good question. There is somewhat grayness in the halacha about what's called the stage of rikum, as to we'll call it achieving form. But these days, usually we're pretty accurate these days in terms of knowing when and how and what stage. But nonetheless, the Shulchan Aruch says, so it gives us the 40-day measure. And so today I found that, generally speaking, today it's easier to know that. Usually people talk in terms of weeks today. You know, how many weeks in. So 40 days, we're talking about 5 weeks plus, right? You know, so at that point in time. So the question is when should it be done? This is one of the most complicated questions, because the Torah tells us very explicitly that it should be miben chodesh tifteh, that it should be from a month onwards the pidgin aben should be done. So the question is, what is a month? So some of the poskim can assume a month means 30 days, which would mean that it would be therefore, if you're going to do it, it has to be the 30th day or plus the 30th day. So we'd say the 31st day. The problem is that many poskim also suggest that a month actually refers to the lunar cycle. How long is the lunar cycle? What was that?
29.5 days.
Yes, yeah, so it's the actual measure is 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 chalakim, right? So it's about 29.5 days. That's how long it takes for the moon to orbit the earth. Okay, which is why it's always so complicated, because how do you have half a day in the calendar? So that's why Rosh Chodesh oscillates in our fixed calendar between 2 days Rosh Chodesh and 1 day Rosh Chodesh. When it's 1 day Rosh Chodesh, like this week, that means to say that the month is chaser, that the month is 29 days, which means that we're really taking in Rosh Chodesh before the month, before the lunar, the moon has made its full circuit. In times when we have 2 days Rosh Chodesh, it means the first day Rosh Chodesh is the last day of the month, which means we're adding on an extra 12 hours, and by the time we get to the second day Rosh Chodesh, the moon is already completed its full orbit. There's no way to get a half day into the calendar. That's how our calendar works. But when it comes to a pigeon aben, then the question is, well, you need to make sure that there's enough of a real full month. So you say, well, of course, isn't 30 days always, if I'm doing it on the 31st day, have I not automatically covered 29 days and 12 hours and change? And the answer is no. And that's so fascinating. Why? I'll give you an example. This example just happened recently to me. Here's the situation. Child is born Wednesday afternoon, 3:52 p.m. Mazel tov. Wonderful. Okay, so here we go. Wednesday afternoon baby. Now, by the way, it happens to be 3:52 is pre or post the sunset?
Pre.
even in the deepest of winter, which is where we are at right now. So this is a Wednesday afternoon baby. How do you get to day 30? Day 30 is a very simple calculation. You count the day of birth and you count day 30, plus 4 weeks plus 1 day, right? So I actually I have these printed out, but could somebody give me a run to the printer for me? I'm sorry, I was just printing. I'm sorry, I'd love to show everybody. This was like, thank you so much, Michael. So you fast forward 4 weeks, and you turn to the next day, which is Thursday. Thursday would be the 30th day. It always sounds a little funny because you're like, why would the next day be 30? The answer is very simple. If you count the day itself, Wednesday is day one, right? So you get to day 28. When is day 28? On a Tuesday, right? Because a week is 7 days. So day 29 is Wednesday. Day 30 is Thursday.
It's like your birthday, you're 13 days and the day of your birthday, you're 13 years and 1 day.
Exactly. This is how it works. It always is one extra day. 4 weeks and 1 day is 30, right? So we say, okay, so let's do post a month. Let's say it's the 31st day. So therefore, technically speaking, I should be able to do the Pidyon HaBen on Thursday night, right? Because Thursday night essentially is the beginning of the 31st day. I've now have 30 days. But if you do the 29 days and 12 hours, it'll turn out that the 12 hours actually really ends at 3:52 a.m. So Michael, I actually have the notes on the bottom there. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm going extemporaneous lens right now. Thank you so much. So thank you so much. And the rest is actually over here. If you would, do you want to just pull up, folks, can you just tie this out a little bit? I was going to show the diagram on this one. I think this is helpful to see. Take a look on page 3. If you go on Thursday night, which is really the 31st day, you're actually still within 29 days and 12 hours, if you actually count it, right? Because that 12 hours actually expires, it starts counting on Wednesday afternoon. Now, it's true that day, the next day started half an hour later when the sun set, but that still is within the 29 hours, the 29 days and 12 hours of the baby being born. Which means to say that the Thursday night would not be a full, we'll call lunar cycle, a lunar orbit later than when the baby was born. So the only way to really do it would be to do it on Friday morning, which is why in halacha, you'll notice that Pidyon HaBens are recommended to be done on the morning of the 31st onwards, right? Because by that way, you will always be out of the range of the we'll call it the lunar cycle as well. And so that happens to be, so the question that was asked at this time is, Friday morning is really difficult. And it happens to be, it would not be all right to do on Thursday nights, because that would not be within, that would be in within the range of the lunar cycle. So what does one do in that situation? So the really, technically speaking, the best thing to do would be to have a Friday morning brunch or morning or breakfast. Failing to do so, one can certainly do it on Motzei Shabbos, But there is you can't do it on Shabbos. You can't do money exchanges on Shabbos. But nonetheless, there is a mitzvah to do it earlier than later as well. Which is why, if you remember the time you've been invited to a Pidyon HaBen most recently, they're usually at an inconvenient time, right? And that's part of the reason is because you're trying to do it as early as possible from the time that it's allowed, the earliest. And it becomes difficult to do this. So if you remember these times, I remember weekday mornings and everybody's rushing and it's very hard. Because of this, in order to facilitate this, but it's important to visualize to be able to see how this works. This is actually, by the way, this is a example which just happened. Pidyon was just a week ago. So yes.
The child is born, and for whatever reason, the doctor says we have to delay the bris.
Yes, we'll get that in a second. Because, by the way, this happens. It happens a number of times. Now, who? So a few things. Yeah.
You want to make how many 29 days and 12 hours after the
at least
that's the ideal time.
After the lunar cycle, after the month.
Why is it Friday morning? Why isn't it Thursday? 29 days is Wednesday.
If you actually pin it in on the calendar and you actually count those 29 days from the time in the day, not the calendar day, right? Then it's going to still overlap. It's still going to be Thursday night. If you actually count, if you just count 1 day, meaning start, you would start the count on Thursday now, essentially, not Wednesday, because the baby was born on Thursday afternoon, right? So if you start, you're right, but if you want to count the hours, Now, that really, the first 24-hour cycle is going to only finish on Thursday afternoon at 3:52. So it's essentially a shorter day. That's if you want to do the calculation, okay?
You're not counting Wednesday as day one.
You can't really, because if you're counting 24-hour circuits, then it's going to be day one will end on the 3:52 Thursday afternoon, then through Friday 3:52, and it's going to come out that you're short. That's precisely the concern, is the situation.
Why would there be just the way we count the days for bris and days for pinyon, where it mixes young, count?
That's a great question, because the problem is that the Torah uses not days over here, but it uses a yerach. It uses bin chodesh tifte. So when it becomes bin chodesh, the definition of chodesh may be different in this case, as opposed to defining yom me'ais la'ais. It happens to be that when it comes to a bris, there is a time where we count me'ais la'ais, which is in that 24 cycle. And that is let's say a child is sick. We didn't discuss this last week, but let's say a child is sick in a situation where they have to go to the NICU, or we're not just talking about, you know, Billy Rubin's got a high count. We're talking about a serious situation here. And then the doctor says, gives the green light and says this baby's all right. The halacha is we wait 7 days, but we may wait me'ais la'ais. But that's a separate calculation. That's called not based on interpreting the psukim. That's that we give a window to ensure that even though medically speaking this baby is viable for a bris, we give that time, which is why you'll remember later brises could sometimes be in mid-afternoon, right? And that's as a function of that 24 hours from the time the doctor gave the go-ahead plus 7 days. Okay, so just to understand that as well. Yeah, Dr. Hardiman, we haven't got so far yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a little technical thing.
Yes.
This time, the 29 days, 12 hours, and 7 nights of walking, that's an average. That's not the truth.
You're right.
Conjunction could be 13 hours.
You're right. It does make it a little more complicated to start going out and measuring the moon every month. You're right. We deal with averages because it helps us set our months as well. Dr. Donald, you're right.
But in the winter, the Earth is moving faster around in the northern hemisphere. The Earth is moving faster around the sun.
You're right. You are right. We have to deal with averages, or otherwise we will never be able to end on a chayim. Right? And it's also the average person is not going to be able to do this. So we take that average, and the average proves correct, meaning to say over the course of the year, we will. That's the way we're doing. But technically speaking, you are correct. And again, also the nitan Torah and the malachei asharis. We have to, in a human way as well, which is, your average person doesn't even know this, but we as Jews, this is something we can know. So a few other things, Kohanim, when it comes to who is the Kohen it should be with, so there's a whole discussion, they say that the Vilna Gaon redeemed himself 5 times in his lifetime. He was the firstborn, and he redeemed himself 5 times because he didn't trust the yichus of the Kohanim that he was dealing with, but that's not the accepted practice. That's not generally the way that things go. We find a Kohen who has not got any claims on their yichus or their lifestyle, and we redeem we're based on that Kohen. That's the best we can possibly do. If there are questions, then if there's questions about their yichus, if perhaps a Kohen them or somebody in their family married a divorcee. These are questions on the yichus, and that shouldn't be done. That should be avoided. But failing such, if there's no reason to question it, the assumption has been is there's enough grounds to be able to do this, and that's generally the way it works as well. And there are some very distinct kohanim, distinguished kohanim who do this many many times. It becomes their thing. How much money do we need to do? So the Torah tells it has to be 5 slaim. That's the Torah. What we're told based on the pasuk in Parshas Bamidbar, which describes the interchange of the Kohanim and the Levim, 5 slaim. Why is that? Rashi actually makes an observation that the reason is because that was what the price that they sold Yosef for. The brothers, when they sold Yosef down the river, they sold Yosef at such a price. And there's an element, Yosef was being a Bechor Li'imoy, the firstborn for his mother. And so we replicate that. If you think about that, that is an element then of Kapara, of atonement, that's being sought out, which is really really fascinating as well. What does that turn into? So the Shulchan Aruch actually explicitly says that this is silver, which is 30 dirham. Dirham is a particular measure of silver. The problem is that it fluctuates over the centuries as to what that precisely is. Is it 2.8 grams? Is it 3.2 grams? It's a little bit of a gray area. But assuming even let's say the most, so 3.2 grams is, and it happens to be there's 30 of them. So we talk about 96 grams of silver, and so it depends on the silver price. I checked last night on Friday, and that turns into $75 worth of silver today. So what, usually there's there are coins which are used. One needs to make sure that the silver coins are worth more than at today's silver price, which is $75. It's not so hard to imagine that's the case. And the question is, who really has those? So technically speaking, the way it's supposed to work is dad is supposed to give money to the coin. But a lot of times you'll have the coin, he's got his set of coins, right? And he doesn't want to really part with his set of coins. Now, technically speaking, so what will he do? He'll give it as a gift to dad. Then dad will give the coin to them. Or perhaps another way it's arranged is the coin will sell it to dad, right? So now the father has paid for the silver. He'll now give the silver back to the coin, and that would be the way it works as well. Another possibility is you could go to some sophisticated Judaica stores and buy them at a good rate. And believe me, they're charging you more than the 30 dirham market value. But nonetheless, that's part of it as well. And one gives it. It's just funny because sometimes you'll have the dad say, you know, I spent so much money on this, you know, can I get it back? And the answer is no. That's the point of the Bidjan Aben, right? So if the coin decides to give you a gift, that's fine, but he's offering you a service in the end of the day. So one should not expect to get one's money back when it comes to this as well. But it has to be the certain benchmark, which is why it's worthwhile just doing a little bit of research on the current silver price as well. So the format is very interesting to anybody who's been at a Pidjan Aben, as opposed to most mitzvahs. There's actually a dialogue which is set up, and the dialogue is in Aramaic. So just quickly looking at this dialogue. So the person brings this person says Zeh b'ni b'chori hu peter rechem ni'imoy v'akosh baruch hu tzivu lo liftoy so shenem ufuzuyev b'chorish tifte b'erkoch kesef chamesh shkolim b'shekel ha'kodesh estim k'erahu. So the father says, look, this is the Torah tells us this is what we're supposed to. We're supposed to redeem our children. This is my firstborn to my wife. And he has the pesukim tell us this. So then the coin turns to him and says, my boy is tvei, what do you want more? Do you want to give me the redemption value, or do you want to keep the child? So then at this point in time, you know, there's all the guys at the back who are chuckling and say, sell him. So, you know, there's always one of those. It's like, I always wondered, how long in marriage does it take to start making the cynical marriage jokes to the new chassanim? It's like, keep quiet. You've got problems in your marriage. Don't tell him jokes. Like, right, so anyway. But like, so you have all these people, sell him. Right, so at this point in time, there's the father says, he says, I want to redeem my child. Here's the money as the Torah prescribes. And then there's a brach which is made on the Pidjan Aben, beautiful, and there's a shechianu, and then the kohen takes the money, and similar to what has become later on, the notion in Kapora, zeh tachazeh, zeh chilov zeh, zeh machol hazeh, and the kohen waves the money above the child and says a birkas hagefen as well. Why the dialogue? Because it makes it seem as if there's an element of autonomy over the child that the father has. And in all honesty, it's not really true, right? And so the Piskei Tshuva actually quotes this in Shulchan Aruch. He quotes the Chut HaShani, Rav Bachrach, and he says that that's not the way it works. You don't have a choice. Yeah, you can't leave your child up for adoption. This is not the way it works. The reason this is done is because this is a mitzvah which requires intent. It requires understanding what you're doing. And if a person is to be giving a gift to the kohen and happens to be the child in the room, that does not suffice as a Pidjan Aben. So therefore, to educate. The father, to educate those around, that what's really going on is because the Torah told us, therefore it's set up in a dialogue, because the father has to respond what he is doing, so he knows what he's doing as well. That's what's understood as over here as well. It would be invalid if the father chose the other option as well. This is this is what the poskim suggests as well. What if the child did not have a bris? This happens a number of times. So let's say, I remember that in our shul, we had twins that were born. And so the twins needed to be in the NICU, and they needed to gain enough weight for a bris. But guess what? The Pidjan Aben came first. That's totally fine. It just happens to be that it's only baby A, baby Aleph who gets the Pidjan Aben, because baby B does not warrant it. But there's been many times where a baby will have their Pidjan Aben before they have their bris milah, and that's how it goes. It's just a little more difficult because you can't really invite people with the name. So it becomes a little more interesting. But that's totally, I've been to such a Pidjan Aben as well. So it happens to be, this is more complicated, is you know, where and with whom. It is nice to have a minyan, and it's nice to have a surah's mitzvah, but if you need to do this and the baby's in the hospital, you can do it. As long as the baby, Baruch Hashem, is viable, meaning if the baby is stable, then you're able to do this, and you're able to do it in the hospital as well. One of the big shahadas which has come up recently, unfortunately, is in the Israeli army, is what happens if the father's not present. You know, so that's a very painful shahada. It's like the father can't be there for the pidgin abed. They let him off for the bris milah, right? But then this happens, right? I'm saying this happened many, many, many times, unfortunately. And this is a shahada which has come up again and again and again and again in the Israeli army. And so the truth is that a father can be mashveh shliach. A father can designate an agent to do this on their behalf. I mean, there's a whole discussion here, so who qualifies, but nonetheless, the father does not technically need to be present, although it's his responsibility. And so you'll have, you know, they'll do it on their behalf. The father will FaceTime in from Gaza, that's actually usually not from Gaza, but if they're in a place where they can FaceTime, and that'll be the situation. Which leads us, what was that?
What about the worst case scenario?
Oh, good question. So if the father is not here, I'm trying to remember, where's the Shulchan Aruch? I don't have the Shulchan Aruch over here. The Shulchan Aruch does talk about this case. I don't remember if it goes to the child and waits till later, or somebody else goes in their place.
What happens?
If the father predeceases in the 30 days.
But if the father is, if the baby's not there, it's not right.
Yeah, and also if the baby is not there as well, it is possibly done. Although it's better to do it with in the place of the baby as well.
My father was away on business. He did the pigeon, the baby then.
Yeah. I mean, there's situations as well where there's a child which went in for surgery, at open heart surgery at this time, and then the question is they can't access the baby. Can they do the pigeon? Yes, they can. Such a situation as well. Although, obviously, sky's clear. One would want to be with a child as well. When it gets down to the reasoning behind this, there's a lot of reasons behind this. So the most famous reason, if anybody asks you why we do Pidgin Abem, the most famous why is it takes us to end of Parshas Bamidbar, where the Torah tells us that the Levim are to replace the Bechorim, and there's a, we'll call, one-to-one redemption process. There happens to be more Bechorim than there are Levim. So what do? So you take the five Shkalim, the Torah tells us, of each of those Bechorim, and that is given as a donation, as a redemption for the we'll call the surplus. That's the way it's seen. Why is that done? Rashi tells us very simply, is because when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai and Bnei Israel misbehaved themselves, he calls out and he says, Mila Hashem Eli, and the natural leaders of every family, which should have been the firstborn sons, they should have been the ones to listen to the cry, they did not respond, and it turned out to be the Levim who did. So the Levim now supplant the Bechorim as their as leadership, and the idea of the redemption is, in a certain sense, is a symbolic act to show that this firstborn could have, should have, would have been a leader, but yet is not, and the Levim now take that place in the Beis Hamikdash. That's the general understanding which is given. The problem with that understanding is, what's the issue with this? What is that? What's the issue with this theory? Rashi says this in the question. What's the problem with this theory? Problem is that the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen appears in Parshas Bo, as before, meaning in Parshas Bo in Shmos Yud Gimel, when B'nai Yisrael goes out called Kadesh Li Kol B'chor Peter Rechem B'nai Yisrael, Ba'adam B'Ba'ba Lihu. Right, it's in every man's tefillin. It's one of the four paragraphs in tefillin, end of Parshas Bo. And at that point in time, the Bechorim did not heed the call, because the call hadn't been given until Parshas Kisisa, which was really at least 89 days later, right? Which is when the Mila Hashem Eli call happened. So you can't tell me that Pidyon HaBen is as a function of the lost leadership of the Bechorim, because they only did that later on, and the mitzvah was given beforehand. So the Sforno, very famous, is Rav Avadia Sforno, in his commentary on the Torah, both in Parshas Bo and in Parshas Bamidbar, makes the observation that the reason why we do Peter Rechem of Pidyon HaBen is not as a function of the lack of leadership. That was a one-time operation, meaning the firstborn children at the times of Moshe Rabbeinu didn't heed their calling, and therefore they were exchanged for the Levim, and the surplus were exchanged for the five Shkalim. That was a one-time event. But the reason why Pidyon HaBen exists every generation from then till time immemorial is for another reason, and that is that at the time of Makas Bechoras, HaKadosh Baruch Hu releases an agency, a mashchis, which is now going through Egypt to destroy all firstborns. That was the and this agency would have killed the firstborns of Israel were it not for the fact that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the mitzvah to put the blood on the lintels and the doorposts of the houses, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu be'atzmoy stood there and prevented the mashkes from entering into the houses. In a certain sense, he took ownership over the Bukharim. There's a certain kedusha based on that ownership. Hashem now, their lives are owed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for not having been killed like every other firstborn was killed in Egypt. That, and therefore, that ownership comes with a level of kedusha. So there's a holiness which is imbued into every firstborn based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu saving their lives. And that being the case, that holiness needs to be redeemed, which means were it not for the pigeon Aben, it's not that this is about leadership at all, it's that there's a certain innate kedusha which is now expressed into this firstborn son. And if you were to not have a pigeon Aben, he would be like a Nazir. He would be a person who had to be celibate, as separate from this world, not involved in anything, until such time as that kedusha is now given over to the Kohen as well. Yes, Yossi. Yes. It's exactly. That's precise. Exactly. Exactly. What's confusing is the second exchange in Parshas Bamidbar. That's where people go, and the money is described explicitly there, which is what parallels what it is. So Sforno says, don't get confused. Go back to Kadesh Liko Bukhar. That's exactly what he's saying. It's precisely because it's Kedusha. That being the case, then you have to ask yourself a very good question, which is, why celebrate? Like, meaning to say, like, shouldn't we, like, at this point in time, what you're essentially saying is, this child is like Hekdesh, he's like property of the Beis HaMikdash. And that being the case, we're going to take the money, exchange, put the Kedusha on the money, the Koineh now has the rights of that holiness, because that's a lot of times where the Matnas Kuna goes to, of Kedusha, like Bikurim and so on. So if that's the case, then you should be sad. You should say, like, okay, well, like, you know, this little Reuven had Kedusha, no longer has Kedusha, why are we celebrating? Why is there a Surah Mitzvah? So actually, it's a good opportunity to take a look at the MS Le'Yakov, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, at the end of Parshas Bo, where he quotes this Sephorna, and he says, but this speaks to the core of Judaism. When you say in the non-Jewish world, in the secular world, how is that I'll create holiness? The answer is that I will do it by insulation and separation. So holiness is, you know, I will be very holy in church, and I will not eat this and not go there. And the holiest of peoples will be celibate until the church changes their minds, right? And so it's all separate from this world. Spirituality is seen as distinct from physicality, whereas Jews is completely the opposite. We're a material being, a vehicle which holds a soul, and somehow we have to succeed together. Somehow we have to elevate that soul together. The way Rav Nachman of Breslov says, some people eat in order to be able to learn Torah. I learn Torah in order to be able to eat. So it's like it's taking those physical activities and being able to do this. So when we have a child who's now not able to be involved in this world, that itself is seen as a lacking. So upon the redemption and the involvement, the ability of this child to now be involved in mundane activities and bring spirituality to them, that's seen as a simcha as well, which is fascinating, which is the reversal of the way the world looks at us as well. There are other reasons as well, which are really worthwhile thinking about. And actually, I was really struck by this. Actually, at Rabbi Jason Strauss had a pigeon I've been a few years ago for his Bechor Akiva, and he quoted this really remarkable correspondence, which I was not aware of. Which I asked him for afterwards, which is, I thought was really fascinating. And this was a correspondence between Reverend James Walsh and Rabbi Soloveitchik. So he corresponded. He was assigned to the Park Street Catholic Information Center in Boston, and he served there in the 1940s and 50s. Rav Soloveitchik himself wasn't a fan of interfaith dialogues, public interfaith dialogues. But this fellow had a lot of questions for him. And so Soloveitchik actually responded to him. So this particular letter was to Reverend James Walsh, and it's not dated, but it has to be in the early 50s or late 40s, where he responds about this idea of the firstborn. So take a look at this on page 7. I just thought it was really, really beautiful. He acknowledges the receipt of the letter, and then he says, the standard ceremonial of the redemption of the firstborn on the son on the 31st day of his birth, by the father, to which the Pentateuch refers to in Exodus 13:13, Numbers 18:15-16, and as follows. So he says only, and he quotes the Hertz background, and he says Only against this background might we understand the institution and consecration of the redemption of the firstborn son. Children are the greatest and most precious charge God has entrusted to man's custody without granting any property rights to them. Man, willy-nilly, must acknowledge this irrevocable though bitter truth. He must be ready to lose everything if losing is what God demands. He must also always answer the call summoning him to perform heroically the movement of withdrawal from the most tightly knit and natural community on earth, that of a father and son, to retreat from positions which psychologically speaking, man lacks the courage to abandon, because departure from these positions would mean to ordinary unredeemed person self-displacement and existential uprootedness. And now he hits the core of the issue, which is the offering of Isaac is exemplary of this type of sacrificial service of God. Our Midrashic scholars maintained that God, when he commanded Abraham to take his son and offer him on the mountain, did not will him to bring physical sacrifice consisting of blood, burnt flesh, and fat. All he willed Abraham to do was to relinquish his son, whom he showered with love that tore down all barriers separating two individuals beings and united them both in one existence. He wanted Abraham to abandon the pretense of possessiveness, all claims of unity and identity, all hopes of self-perpetuation and immortalization through Isaac, and return him to whom he belongs. This sacrifice was to express itself not in extinction of the physical Isaac, nor in the separation of the child from its parents, nor the actual consecration of Isaac to the Lord within the framework of the temple service in the manner foreshadowing Hannah sending Samuel to the Lord, but in the spiritual retreat of the father from his son for a short period of time. Abraham had to disengage himself for a while from his emotional involvement with his heir and son. Abraham made this movement of withdrawal from Isaac, and Isaac was returned to him. A new gift was bestowed upon Abraham, or to be more exact, a new charge was placed on him in his trust at the Mount of Moriah. This is such a profound way of looking at the Akedah. The Akedah is not the sacrifice of Isaac, but the recontextualization of Isaac. That's what the Rasul Echik is saying. It's not yours. He's not your possession. He's not something that you can do with him what you want. And by the way, it seems that that was the basic understanding of society in those days. If you understand what is behind child sacrifice, infanticide, which was very, very common in the Middle East in those days. If you read, and that's why the Torah has to emphasize multiple times, Al titein es bincha la molech, don't give your child to Molech. Molech was one of the Canaanite pagan deities. In fact, when they were doing the archaeological digs at Carthage, right? So Carthage, one of the Phoenician cities now in the Lebanon area, they found many, many urns of ashes which were inscribed upon them MLK in Ugaritic, not referring to Martin Luther King, but to Molech. They assumed that the ashes were children that parents had sacrificed. Now, how could you possibly do that? The answer is, well, if a child is an asset, right? The child is an asset, and I need to make certain sacrifices to appease the gods in order for me to have success and to be a boon in the fields and to be more children. I'm going to do what it takes, because after all, it's mine. I created this. What was the name of the first child born in the world? Cain. Why does she call him Cain? Ki kanisi ish es elokim. She says, I can create. I've made somebody. It's mine. No, that's not yours. That's Hashem says, wait a second. I allowed you, I gave you this biological process, fantastic. Understand something over here. It's not yours, right? This does not belong to you. And that's what the Arcata was supposed to be. So every time there's a pigeon aben, there's a recreation of that in a certain sense. When you have to have that uncomfortable conversation, my boy is tvei, what do you really, really want over here? The what's supposed to be imbued is the fact that this is not yours and you don't have the right to do with it. You don't have, it's a lease, right? And you have the charge to make sure that it gets to a certain destination. But make sure you don't damage this. Make sure that this is not seen as something that you can bargain, overlook, dispossess. This is not something that you have the rights on. That's what Dora Soloveitchik says. So in a certain sense, it's a grand sense of sacrifice or recontextualization of children. And that's and by the way, the world today takes that for granted to a large extent. But this came from the Abrahamic moment of the Akedah itself. On the flip side, if you want to actually go the opposite way, Rabbi Mechaya says, he quotes a pasuk in Yeshaya, which is, Hasishkach isha privitna. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. What does that mean? What's the idea behind that pasuk? Will a woman forget the child of a woman? Now, dads, you know, as important as dads think they are, in the whole process, are less consequential in the whole birthing process and child raising process, unfortunately, because you don't really necessarily know who the father is without DNA testing, right? But the mom always knows who the baby is. The mom will always know. Says Yishayel, has Seshkach Isha Privid? No. Will a woman forget the child that she bore? No. A woman will always know, this is my child. There's no way for her to forget. And that's seen as a metaphor for what? For HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with us. Where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the mother of Klal Yisrael. He'll never forget us, despite all the things that we do wrong. Despite all the times we slam the door and we shout and all the things we do in our teenage, so to speak, years of nationhood. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu will always remember us. So in a certain sense, says Aben Mechaya, that is what a pigeon Aben is as well. It's not the sacrifice or the removal or the withdrawal of the parents to know that this child's not theirs. No, it's the opposite, that Aben Mechaya says. It's the acknowledgement that when I brought a child into this world, there's no going back. This is a lifetime's, well, I won't say sentence, but responsibility. We're going to always worry. No matter if they're 2 years old or 30 or 40 or 50 years old, we're still not going to sleep at night because we care about them. Hasishkach isha privit no, we're never going to forget. Our children will always be in our minds, in our consciousness as well. I remember it was such a striking scene in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the first one in the 1959? When did it come out? 60, okay, so in Sydney, there was a young Sydney Poitier, right? Remember? And anyway, so it's just a very beautiful, it's a societal question, essentially. So there's a young lady who grows up, I think San Diego, is it? Right, some West Coast progressive space, and this young lady starts dating a young black man who's very accomplished. He's a doctor, he's a respected physician, and which is at that time was much harder to achieve. And she brings him home for dinner, and her father has been this progressive liberal who's been talking about all these ideas, but until his daughter brings back this fellow, which at this time, you know, a biracial couple, this is just, you know, not accepting. He's struggling with all his, we'll call it closet bigotry, right, is the way that he's accused. And then on the other hand, his family, this young man, this doctor's family, is also up in arms. A white girl, you and so, and it's this clash of cultures. So the father of this doctor brings him in and he says, son, and the father was a mailman, and he says, son, do you know how many miles I carried that mail bag in the cold in order to put you through school, and now you go and you decide you're marrying this girl without telling us, and how could you do this to us? That was the father's observation. Do you know how many times your mother sacrificed getting a winter coat, and now you're doing this to us? And the boy responds, the son says, Dad, he says, I don't care if you had to carry that mail bag a million miles. The reason why you had to do that was because you brought me into this world. And as a father, you have the responsibility of looking after a child. Don't claim that as emotional leverage. I was thinking, like, it was a very profound conversation. The problem was that the voices were mixed up. It should have been the other way around. The father should be saying, you know what, son? He says, I made a lot of sacrifice for you, but ultimately I was responsible to do that. And the son said, you know, Dad, I know you're responsible, but I can't imagine the sacrifices you made. It's like, should be the other way around, right? It should be recognizing everybody else's point. That never happens in arguments like this. But if you think about it, that what Rabbeinu Mechaya is saying is that a father, a mother will have this, we'll call it lifelong responsibility, which they can never shake in a child. And that's what's happening at the Pigeon Aben as well. There's no way to escape this. You come home from the hospital, all the fanfare, the balloons, the donuts, everything. And now at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's what happens. Is you're saddled with the incredible responsibility of parenthood, which is never going to go away as well. And we'll close with the idea of the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch says the Pidgin Aben is not the only time that we deal with this. In fact, in any other element of success in life, we always give the first, right? Truma, Chala, Bikurim, it's even Bechorat, it's the same thing. Anything first we do. So this is the Sefer HaChinuch, because human beings are very fast to say, Konisi Ish Ez Elokim. Look at me, look what I did. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, yeah. You make sure you're going to dedicate the first to remind yourself that I gave you the license to succeed. I gave you the withhold. That door that opened when you didn't expect it, that was me too. Right? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu reminds us, and the Pidyon HaBen is in part of that ark. I think it's the most profound aspect of the ark because it's the one that requires the most amount of effort, investment, and sacrifice. But it's a reminder that even our own children are so to speak, with the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So very, very profound mitzvah, lots of very interesting applications, Be'ezra Hashem. We should all have also been able to do this many times throughout the generations and being present there for our children, Be'ezra Hashem. Anyways, Yashar Koichachem, thank you so much for taking the time today, everybody.